Croeso and welcome to Tales for Wales, the pod that never fails to broker a truce between the bants and history, to charge the fields of the past and to consolidate podcast power on the Welsh events of old. I'm Jack, and as usual, I'm joined by my head counsel, Franco. Who is this man who speaks to me as though I needed his advice?
Who is this man who speaks to me as if I needed his advice?
Any old excuse to get that quote in there.
Man, it's been a while since I've watched old Braveheart. I might have to stick it on soon.
The last time I watched it, I was absolutely rat-ass. Yeah. Right? Like, you know, when you just Best time to watch it. Yeah, it's great. Mm. But you know when it's the slow build-up, which is always great when you're, if you can hang on, it's great. This is like a sort of 6 a.m. kind of situation.
I'm in and out,
and it's like if it was in the battle, you know, I'd be pumping fists and stuff. Yeah. But in that bit, I'm just going, just humming along to myself.
Well, this is probably old news by the time it's come out, but I thought for once we should do something like actually meaningful. And I was just getting so angry at the.
What are you trying to say?
Well, no. Before, because it's, you know, it's a lighthearted podcast, but I just wanted to like mention when I was, I don't, you know, politics can get boring, but I want to just quickly chat about the Tata Steel and the steel stuff in Scunthorpe.
Don't fucking blow my blood, sunshine.
Well, I know you'd be up on it, but just in case other people aren't, I think, like, you know, if you're downloading this podcast, you care about Welsh history. And I think what's happening at the moment is like genuinely diabolical. And I know this will come out a couple of weeks' time, and it's probably a bit past when we should be talking about
it. Yeah, it'll be a week like out of the news cycle by now.
Yeah, but I think that's even more important to remember it. Mm. So like I know it's not our job specifically to like to wane on about politics, but this is about history. This podcast is about history, and I think this is quite historical. So like for context, when Tata Steel, that employs 2,700 skilled workers in Port Talbot, which is a town that relies solely on that industry, the rest of it is pretty, you know, there's not an awful lot going on there. It was built specifically for that industry.
You're talking like generations of employment in that place. Yeah.
When it faced closure, the Tories didn't give a fuck. And of course they don't. They don't give a fuck about Wales at all. They don't care about Welsh jobs or Welsh Steel. Mm-hmm. But that's we kind of knew that with them. At the time, Welsh Labour were like, you know, they were like obviously trying their best not to get it closed down. So the minute Labour come in, they do nothing whatsoever to help to nationalise the steel. So what lots of parties in Wales were saying is nationalise the steel, protect these jobs and make sure we don't lose the ability to create steel in this country. Because if for some reason other countries turn against you, or like China imposes massive tariffs or America imposes massive tariffs, you then have to pay a shit ton for creative things.
You don't want to be stuck fucking with no ability to create your own. Yeah.
So the minute then Labour came in, so Labour in Westminster, Plaid Cymru and people like that were saying nationalise it, and then Welsh Labour were saying it's a pipe dream, it's ridiculous, of course they can't nationalise it, it's a pipe dream to like save these communities.
Never gonna happen.
And then the exact same thing happens in England, affecting less jobs. Labour act and they nationalise it, and if that doesn't show like the utter disregard and the fucking disdain for the Welsh economy and more importantly Welsh livelihoods, then I don't know what does. And I know we don't get too serious, but my mum always fucking hated Labour more than the Tories, and I was always confused. I was like, she's a left-leaning, community-focused old dear, she's an old biddy. And I was like, how do you hate Labour? Because like, I'm left-leaning, and I don't, you know, I'm not a Labour voter, but I've always thought that, well, at least they're a bit more kinder. But she said she said the Tories always said who they were, and they always were like, you know, outright about their attitude towards Wales and their disdain for working people. Whereas Labour,
they were openly horrible.
Labour faked it. And when Labour came in after Thatcher, they closed more mines than Thatcher's government did. And like they've had such a fake kind of ride of being these people, like these working for the working class. And now these Labour are in, and they're raising taxes more.
They take Wales for granted as well, because we vote Labour time and time again as a country, don't we? And they absolutely don't. They feel like they don't need to.
Yeah.
Keep their promises, they don't need to do anything like that, because they just think, they'll all vote red anyway.
Exactly, and I think it's that kind of disdain and that fucking, Wales will just do it. It's like, I really think if we just keep the conversation going for a little bit longer, and we just, some people who might not know about this story, hopefully it gets you annoyed and think, who the fuck do they think they are to treat us like this?
Yeah, it's infuriating. And it's like when it was, because Wales have been in power in the Welsh government since its fucking inception, basically.
So Labour had been in power.
Labour, sorry, Labour, yeah. But in Westminster, you know, that's changed a few times, and for Tories the last 14 odd years.
Yeah.
But there was something I remember Welsh Labour always used to say, hands are tied.
Yeah.
Can't do anything because, you know, whoever in
Wales,
the Tories, they're blocking everything. We'd love to do all this great stuff for Wales, we just can't block. And then it's like, right, Labour are in Westminster now, so surely that's a free pass to do all these things you've been promising for years. And they're going, fuck all.
And I don't know if it's the same stat, but we were regarded as the second poorest country in Europe. And if they say, oh, Wales can't afford to be an independent country, we're doing shit as it is. We're doing shit with England holding your hands back. So at least give it a try yourself.
I'd rather be doing shit and it's like our own choices, our own doing. Know, rather than being hamstrung.
We have to pay so much money to the Crown Estate, £500 million a year from the Crown Estates on the sea beds alone. And the fact that we give our water away for free, we do all this stuff that we could generate money on.
They pay fuck all next door over the border for our water. If we did a going rate, the actual going rate, we'd have millions more in the back, but in the back pocket.
And we wouldn't have to pay towards...
We produce double the electricity we use. Yeah. It's like, you know, there's so many things we do well, but we're just so hamstrung all the time.
Yeah, and I just feel like Wales has been stagnant for like decades now. Like we're the only country we're the only ones who have a really, really stagnant economy. And I just think when we read about history, I think this is a moment in history where I think there will be a time where I think people will be much more inclined to not vote Labour, and that'll be the first time in four years.
Well, I'm sort of excited and anxious about the Senate elections because they're coming.
You're either massively right wing.
Next 2 years now. Yeah, this is what I worry about. Is it going to, because people are not happy with Labour, like you can sense it and see it, you know, plenty of people are not happy about it. And it's going to one or two ways. Like, I think it'll go Plaid, which is our like Welsh National Party, for those who don't know. And then there's Reform, which is like, I don't want to tar it with a very broad brush, but.
It's a very right wing.
The very right wing, anti immigrant, all this sort of stuff. Yeah. And my opinion on them is that they could not give a flying fuck about Wales either. I don't think they have any policies even relating to Wales,
they don't.
Quite honest.
Yeah. They didn't even have like a Welsh, like a. So even the
they
Tories.
They don't have a Welsh candidate, do they?
Well, they have. They didn't have. When you have the Tories, you have like Secretary of State for Wales, and you have people in positions to be like the Welsh Affairs person. And I don't think for a long time they'd even had one for Wales in Reform. But they've now realised that they could do very well in Wales because Wales won't vote Tory, and they've just voted out all the Tories 2 years ago in the national, about a year ago in the elections. They, you know, there's not a single Tory MP in Wales, but. People are really pissed off for Labour, so it was a choice between Plaid. No one really voted for Dem or
And I just
Reform.
Really worry that it's going to go, there's going to be a majority Reform and we're going to end up in a fucking, like, with a government that just gives it even less of a shit again. And it's like, I don't think they'll solve any problems.
No, I don't think they'll ever get a majority, but I do think it could be in a position where it's like a split between Reform, Tories, and whoever, like independents. So I don't know, but I know it's like we don't really want to get too serious on the pod, but it's just it's something that's worth mentioning at the moment.
Because it's been boiling my blood on the news all this week as well.
Yeah, and by the time this comes out, this probably would have died down a little bit. But the only people who were kicking off about it seemed to be Plaid Cymru, and like everyone else is just like, oh, it just happens. Yeah,
it's like bloody the HS2 stuff, no one's going to be kicking off like that apart from them as well. But
and it's hard to not discuss politics when you discuss history because they're so...
And I just love Wales so much. I just want to see it succeed, for God's sake.
Yeah, no, give us a chance, you bastards.
Give us a bloody chance, guys. Yeah.
Oh, what? Should we go back to...
Anyway.
All right, mate. Are you doing Welsh lads? We're getting a little bit offended there.
Go back to the jokes now.
We'll go back to the ha-has if you like. Do a little joke if you like. I'll tell you when you tell me one. Oh, I don't
Shall I do a quick Patreon shout out?
Well, I feel like it's a bit serious. They might feel a bit like they're tied to
this one. I think we can maybe
hyper left wing politics.
We can do our classic. Let's make a nickname out of them, and maybe that'll be a bit lighter. Oh. You reckon?
Sorry, was that all right for us to chat about?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, ledge.
I think all it's right. fine. So yeah, just to do a little Patreon shout out to try and. Lighten the mood a little bit there when we do our shit nicknames attempts. Next up is Jacqueline Madden. Or Jacqueline, I'm not sure. Jacqueline Madden. Either way.
Jacqueline Wilson.
What can we do with that? Jacqueline, you say Jacqueline Wilson, that's another Jacqueline I know.
Jacqueline Mad Dog Madden. We have
Mad
a few
Dog Madden.
We do have Mad Dog app. We have a few Mad Dog apps in Welsh history, so it could be
Madden app, yeah. Llewellyn.
Yeah. Jackie O. Jacqueline.
You're just saying other people named Jacqueline.
Right, Jacqueline. So what, how do you spell it? Jacqueline?
With a Q. J-A-C-Q-U-E-L-I-N. Is that a French word? Is that a Jacqueline?
Jacqueline. Oh, Jacqueline. She could be one of our listeners from Brittany.
A Breton.
Jacqueline. Well, we have on this episode, we discussed Joan of Wales. We can have Jacqueline of Wales as well.
Jean of Wales.
How about Wacky Jackie? If you're spoiled,
how about Wacky Jackie? Right. I'm done with this now. How about Wacky Jackie? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, well, you got to be crazy to work here. It doesn't help, but it doesn't help. Oh, but,
I love it. Did you please tell me you got that intentionally wrong? It does help, but it doesn't help.
Does help, but it doesn't help. You know what I mean? Oh, man, I am. Just,
that's the sort of thing Wacky Jackie be fucking turning out.
All right. I like Wacky Jackie. It's actually worked quite well.
Wacky Jackie's back in.
Oh, no, I am Wacky Jackie. I bloody love Welsh history.
You don't have to love Welsh history, but it does help. You know,
don't have to, you know what I mean?
All right, we brought it back there. We're light in tone again now. So go on then, mate. This is part two of Llewellyn Ap Iorwerth, isn't it?
Yeah, this is like Kill Bill part two. Mm. If you haven't seen part one, go back. Yeah, DOS. As I said on the end of last week's episode, Llewellyn Montada. This is the comeback for Llewellyn. So last week we discussed the low point of Llewellyn's reign, where he'd suffered, and I quote, the pitiless vengeance of the hardest heart in Christendom. Llewellyn reached the nadir of his career, and for the next 10 months he obliged to the king's demands. So he conceded a bunch of land, give a bunch of money.
Bend the knee
in all senses. So he was in a real low point. However, one of the other grandsons of Owain Gwynedd launched an attack against English garrisons and troops in Wales. So war was back on the cards, and Llewellyn quickly recovered his position and was like, fuck this, I'm going back to what I do best.
I'm shaking off the shackles. I'm going to feed the dog in me again.
So the other Welsh princes who'd supported King John against Llewellyn soon became disillusioned with John's rule and changed sides. Llewellyn formed an alliance with Gwenwynin of Powys and the two main rulers of Deheubarth, Maelgwyn ap Rhys and Rhys Grieg, and they all rose up against John. They'd even had the support of Pope Innocent, who's, you know, the most innocent man in history.
As you all know, if that guy's on your side, you're safe as houses. You're golden, innocent, boy.
Yeah, just don't check it under his bed.
Don't check his hard drives, all right?
He's innocent. It's all in the name. He'd been engaged in a dispute with John for several years. Pope Innocent released Llewellyn, Gwenwynin, and Maelgwyn from all their oaths of loyalty to John and lifted them and all the territories that they controlled. So they'd had the blessing from the Pope now to go up against King John. Llewellyn was able to recover all Gwynedd apart from the castles of Deganoy and Rhythlan within just 2 months. John planned another invasion of Gwynedd in August 1212. According to one account, he'd just commenced by hanging some of the Welsh hostages given in the previous year. You know, I said in the last episode, Llewellyn handed over a bunch of hostages, including his son. A bunch of people had just been hung by King John, and we don't know who yet. So whilst he was doing that, he was getting ready to invade into Gwynedd, where he received two letters, one from his daughter, Joan, Llewellyn's wife, and then the other from William of Scotland, William the Lion. Both of them in the letter warned them in similar terms that if he invaded Wales, his magnates would seize the opportunity to kill him or hand him over to his enemies. So he was like hated in England as well. So had he left to invade Wales, he'd have been taken over in England. So the invasion was abandoned, and in 1213, Llewellyn took the castles, the remaining castles of Deganoy and Rhythlan. Llewellyn in this period as well made an alliance with Philip II of August. Philip II, also known as Philip August of France, he then aligned himself with the barons who were in open rebellion against John. Even marching to Shrewsbury and capturing it without resistance in 1215. And in 1215 is when John was forced to sign the Magna Carta, and Llywelyn was invited to come and join the barons to sign and be part of this significant giant Magna
Flipping
Carta.
Him the V's from the back bench as well. I can imagine that.
It'd be pretty cool to be able there to sign the thing that makes John bend the knee. So Llywelyn was rewarded with several favourable provisions relating to Wales, which had three main clauses in the Magna Carta. Those would be in that any land or liberties that had been taken against the Welsh princes were restored, the freeing of all Welsh hostages, including Llywelyn's son, who managed to survive the hanging, so didn't get hung. And then the cancellation of all charters unfairly extorted from the Welsh princes, particularly those that affected Llywelyn, which he was forced to sign during that bleak summer of 1211. Yeah. Llywelyn had now established himself as the leader of an independent Prince of Wales. Also, during the English Civil War, what was happening with the barons that was keeping the English busy, Llywelyn decided to march on South Wales, but out of character, he didn't go during the normal seasons of war, which is summer and spring. He decided to in the winter in 1215. So when he reached southern garrisons, they were not expecting or prepared for the assault because he was like attacking outside of the season. It's like going to
seasons in November. Yeah, seasons in war. This time of year, a war.
You're mad.
It's freezing, mate.
But while luck was once again on Llywelyn's side, Wales had an uncharacteristically mild winter. One that was really dry and without huge plummeting temperatures or heavy rain. It was even noted by a native chronicler that there'd never been a milder winter before or after. And it wasn't just weather on Llywelyn's side. The princes who joined him to take over Wales from the Normans and the people before him, they didn't just join his cause, they were now in awe of his military prowess. As Llywelyn marched further south, it became like a travel blog of castles and towns which he and his men conquered. They took over Cadwelly, Llanstefan, St. Clears, Larne, Narberth, Newport, Cardigan, Kilgarran, all these castles were taken. The gods were on his side. So all the Anglo-Saxon / Norman / English troops were there, were all getting butchered and killed and kicked out of England, kicked out of Wales. But the main prize was taking the highly sought after Carmarthen, which had been described as the jewel of southwest Wales. He besieged it, and within only 5 days they surrendered. Although it was no surprise that they did, because according to the English chronicler Roger of Wendover, Llywelyn had deployed a campaign of terror against anyone who wouldn't surrender. He wasn't happy with routing garrisons. He would assure that anyone who didn't surrender when given the choice would be beheaded and put on spikes.
Some Attila the Hun shit. That,
yeah, so he'd always give you a chance to surrender. You was given one chance to surrender, and then if you didn't take it, you were never allowed to be given, you were never excused.
That was just your head on the fucking chopping
and
block.
And everyone in the castle. What I find like remarkable is the unity that Llywelyn managed to build in Wales. Like during his march to reclaim Wales, he had his cousins, Hywel ap Gruffydd ap Cynan and Llywelyn ap Meredydd ap Cynan, Gwenwynin of South Powys, Meredydd ap Robert of Cedwin, Rhys Grieg, who's his utter legend, who we'll talk about in another episode, Maelgwyn ap Rhys and the sons of Gruffydd ap Rhys from Deheubarth and Madog from Northern Powys. Like he just managed to get all these people.
All these guys on the side, yeah.
They're not just princes and noblemen, but you'd also get their soldiers, their estates, their retinue, their tailie, and tailie members, like we know, are these skilled warrior knights, like the royal bodyguards. So the sheer scale of this Welsh war machine deployed by Llywelyn was described as the most powerful war in Wales by historian Sean Davis. It was a landmark moment, as it was the first time he'd led a pretty much united Wales, and it's the first time as a war leader he went into South Wales, which also then inspired the locals to join his cause against the Normans.
It's your Welsh heart beam here and something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, yeah. It's so cool to read of a leader who was just so effective. Like, one period, this guy called William Marshall the Younger, he pops up later in the story. He wanted the Marshall lands back from Llywelyn as part of the 1218 peace treaty. Llywelyn deliberated for ages, and after two meetings, he agreed in principle to some concessions. So they agreed a third meeting to hammer out the details. But Llywelyn never turned up, so Marshall started raiding parties on the Welsh. So then Llywelyn brought a fucking massive army and captured his castles in Narberth and Winston and burnt down the towns and slaughtered his soldiers.
Oh, you fucked up, my friend.
Yeah. So Marshall went crying to King Henry III, who's now the new king of England, and he went there to tell him what's gone on, and King Henry there was meant to rebuke Llywelyn, but Llywelyn just ignored it, and the crown were like, sorry, Marshall, we've done all we can, but just shut up. So,
sent him a strongly worded letter, yeah. Not had a reply, that's all we're going to do.
Like, beforehand, that would involve, they'd send an army in or do this, but Llywelyn was so formidable that they were like, oh, mate, sorry that happened to you, but
it's not worth it, mate. Tough luck, old chum. Yeah.
Like so often we discuss Welsh leaders and they get betrayed or they slip up or fate falls a certain way. But I can finally see why they call him Llywelyn Fawr, Llywelyn the Great. Like he was just so good. Like he conquered, like that list of castles I went through. It was from North Wales to South Wales. He just took everything. And he can, whenever the English tried to do anything, he'd unite people. And then in 1220, his oldest illegitimate son, Griffith, decided he wasn't happy with his lot. So now we have that classic Welsh infighting.
And he wasn't happy. It can only go on for so long, this sort of consistent harmony. Peace, can it?
But he wasn't happy that his half-brother, David, who'd recently been acknowledged as Llywelyn's son by the crown in England, so he rose up and he seized the cantref of Meirionnydd. And this really irked Llywelyn, because it's noted by the Native Chronicle at the time, he said, Llywelyn took the subjugation angrily, and he gathered a host and went upon against Griff and threatened to avenge the attack heavily upon him and all his men. And Griffith, having arrayed his troops ready to fight, boldly awaited his coming father. So this was looking like civil war was about to break out for Llywelyn, which would have been disastrous considering Daddy all the work he'd done. Well. Yeah. And all the work he'd done to like build a united Wales against England for his son to turn against him. And at the time, England were quite preoccupied with the French and the barons and all that stuff. So whilst he consolidated his power, he'd now risk losing his strong Wales because his son, his like illegitimate son, is turned against him.
Yeah, he's kicking up a fuss.
And Welsh nobility saw this as disastrous. So advisors from across the board worked to calm tensions. Some persuaded Griffith to surrender, whilst others counseled Llywelyn to accept the surrender peacefully. And thanks to this, war was averted. But Llywelyn did build a castle near there to safeguard his power for later. And I won't go into too much detail, but sometimes when he made decisions about splitting land that wasn't his own, specifically into Haybarth, it would really piss off princes who it didn't favour. So, for example, Ieuan Rhys, nephew of Rhys Grigg, wasn't given some castles in West Wales by Llywelyn that he probably should have done, and instead Llywelyn gave them to people he preferred. So he was looking to join forces. So that then led to like the people who'd been irked to join forces with William Marshall, who was a Marshall lord, to create like a Welsh Marshall alliance.
These things have a little domino effect, don't they?
Yeah, and things like that would happen, and Llywelyn, so they joined up against him, but before war went to happen, they got the English crown to like organize a truce, and Llywelyn conceded that he was wrong and decided to go back on his decision, and then peace was once again restored, and like respect for Llywelyn was now growing as like this level-headed leader, because he would sometimes say, no, right, that's not your land, I'm taking it off you, and then he'd realize that was actually not the best political thing to do, so he'd then like go back on it, because he would save face, he wouldn't just be like pig-headed.
What an ideal man.
Yeah.
Fighting when he wants to fight, and then level head.
Once again, like luck comes on his side. So that Ieuan, it's actually called Ieuanc, who was the one who should have had the lands, but Llywelyn didn't give them to him originally. He then was like, fine, you have the lands back, and I'll not give them to who I want to give them to. He then went back home, and Ieuanc died really quickly. So then the lands fell back to Llywelyn anyway, and he gave them to the people he preferred. So
why'd you kick up such a goddamn fuss?
Yeah. So it's like Llywelyn has this Midas touch that even when he like backs down, it still works in his favour.
I said the gods, mate. He's smiting down those against him.
I read that he has this brinkmanship, was like a big part of his tactic, which is like what like Donald Trump does now with tariffs, where he goes as far as he can and then pulls them back to negotiate. So similarly with Llywelyn, his big tactic he'd often use, he'd push things to the absolute brink of all-out war to force people to submit to avoid any conflict. But he was also known to be like quite astute, especially when it came to avoiding war with Welsh leaders. So he'd look like he'd bring everyone to the fight, and then he'd be like, oh, actually, no, let's not do it, because I can see you're fucking pissed off.
Read it back a little bit, yeah.
Yeah. That said, in 1223, Llywelyn did invade England, specifically Shropshire, most likely anger at the crown because they were refortifying the castle nearby. There's a place called Kinnerley, and the Kinnerley Castle and Whittingham Castle, and the latter was owned by an old enemy of Llywelyn. So he didn't like the fact that the crown were building castles so close to the border. He saw it as a sign of aggression. Even though it was in England, he was like, fuck this. And he was like,
close to the border.
And he waited until the castles were nearly built, 18 months of work and construction, and then he went and fucking burnt them to the ground. So he was just like, he'd let them use all their money.
For fuck's sake, Llywelyn. Could we not have talked about this when the first brick was put down?
Burning it down. But whilst he did that, Marshall So one of his enemies took advantage of Llywelyn's involvement, and then in St. David's in April raised an army in Ireland and recaptured Cardigan and Carmarthen without opposition, because Llywelyn did that brinkmanship thing where he brings all his men to one place, and then he didn't expect to be attacked from Ireland. So that campaign was supported by a royal army as well, which took possession at Montgomery. So Llywelyn had to come to an agreement with the king at Montgomery in October that year. So it was a bit of like, he was kind of thinking, oh shit, maybe I'm being a bit too fucking heavy-handed and I could go back to being a bit more political. Llywelyn's allies in South Wales were given back lands taken from them by the marshal, by this English uprising, and Llywelyn himself gave up his conquest of Shropshire. So he was like, right, I'll stop attacking England, but you are leaving my allies in South Wales well alone.
Yeah.
In 1222, Llywelyn was engaged in a campaign against Hubert de Burgh, who was a justiciar of England and Ireland and one of the most powerful men in the kingdom. Hubert had been given the lordship of Castle of Montgomery by the king and was encroaching on Llywelyn's land nearby. So the king also raised an army to help this Hubert, who began to build another castle in the Commot of Kerry. And whilst trying to build his castle in Kerry, Llywelyn's men engaged in battle and managed to cause significant losses. But in classic Welsh mode, they retreated quickly so they couldn't get caught. So whilst he was trying to build this castle, which the king had supported, Llywelyn sent some men in at night to fucking smash them up and, you know, do a classic Welsh guerrilla style tactic.
Yeah.
And in doing so, when they had this really quick attack, they actually managed to capture William de Brose, who was Lord of Abergavenny, who's also called Gwilym Ddu, or Black William, by the Welsh, because they detested him and his family because they were incredibly cruel to the people around Brecon and Abergavenny. Yeah. So whilst this Hubert guy was building this big new castle, during one of the raids, the Welsh actually captured this fucking really important person. This attack on the royal army was kept up by Llywelyn's vicious raiding parties. So in October, the royal army was obliged to retreat, and Henry agreed to destroy the half-built castles in exchange for a payment of £2,000, which is fucking so much money.
I was going to say, that would be so much back then. Yeah.
But Llywelyn, being the guy he is, said, all right, I'll do that, but only if I'm going to ransom you, William de Brose, for £2,000. So
call it the price of on the house, please.
Yeah. So it's like a bit of an... But what's crazy is that this part of the story becomes a bit like an episode of EastEnders. Whilst William de Brose was captured, he decided to switch alliances and he actually joined Llywelyn's side. So he was going to take this £2,000 fee to release William. William was going to stay a loyal member of Llywelyn's side. And a marriage was arranged between his daughter Isabel and Llywelyn's heir, Dafydd ap Llywelyn. However... Whilst he was captured, he'd become injured and he was tended to by the wife of Llywelyn, so Joan, the daughter of King John. Mm. And then they began a sordid affair. So they were having an affair.
Didn't.
Yeah. And at Easter 1230, William visited Llywelyn's court. During this visit, he was found in Llywelyn's chambers together with Llywelyn's wife. So William de Brose, was caught in bed with Joan. And on the 2nd of May, de Brose was hung in Llywelyn's courtyard and Joan was placed under house arrest for a year. And I mentioned it on last week's episode, but Llywelyn famously adored his wife and trusted her on council on several occasions. Oh,
broke the poor bastard's heart.
Kind of, yeah. So she'd be so entrusted, she'd be often sent to go deal with the English and she was his rock. So this betrayal fucking really sent him. Under other circumstances, you'd expect the wife during the medieval periods to face a death penalty, but he just couldn't bring himself to do so.
I was going to say, I thought maybe de Brose would get a worse fate than just hanging. I thought, the temper's going to rise and it'll be like a hung, drawn, quartered situation.
What he did, he hung him immediately. And that's really significant. And it speaks to Llywelyn's power because he was meant to go through the English courts. So if something like this happened, you'd take him to court. And he didn't involve the crown.
He just strung him up.
Christ. So he hung a prominent Norman leader without any fear of repercussions. And it sent like shockwaves through English society because they were like, this guy has just hung a member of the English. And there's also a really nice letter that Llywelyn sent to William's wife, so the guy he just hung, written shortly after the execution, inquiring whether they still wish to marry the daughters and the Dafydd and this Isabel.
So the wedding's still on?
And he was like, he said, I don't want this to affect how much I adore your daughter, how much I think, you know, our family should still connect, because everyone else is an innocent party. And the marriage did go ahead.
We can find someone else to walk your daughter down the aisle. Okay, that's on me.
Soz about that. The marriage did go ahead the following year and Joan was forgiven and restored to a position as a princess. I also read, but this has been contradicted, that in 1230, Llywelyn used the title Prince Seps Noalia, so Prince of North Wales. But from that year, then he changed his title to Prince of Aberfraw and Lord of Snowdon. And Aberfraw is like the heart of all these great Welsh dynasties. So it's a really important
big house,
scene.
Yeah.
So apparently that's what he changed to. Although he was more concerned with the reality of power rather than the appearance. So he never claimed or used the title Prince of Wales, despite his authority extending over other rulers in Wales. He wasn't as bothered with that at the time. Apparently there's two like different arguments. Sometimes he would say Prince of these. But now we come to his final campaign. In 1231, there was further fighting. Llywelyn was becoming concerned with the growing power of Hubert de Burgh, the guy who built those castles and in Shropshire. Plus some of his men, who he was incredibly protective over, had been taken prisoner by the garrison at Montgomery, and they were beheaded. And these were some of his, like, he was really, really, because he demanded loyalty, but he expected the same back. So if he was, you know, he'd do what he can to free you. So this agent Llywelyn responded with hellfire and set about burning to the ground the towns and castles of Montgomeryshire, Powys, New Radnor, Hay, Brecon, also all the border towns, and then he captured Neath and Kidwelly. So he went around burning most of Mid-Wales to the ground.
Went ham.
Yeah. He then completed the campaign by recapturing Cardigan Castle. And this discussion was perceived as an overreaction by the King of England. He was like, well, that's a bit much.
I love that. Some consider this a slight overreaction, like burning the fucking border down, essentially.
Yeah. So now King Henry decided to launch a royal invasion. So again, getting all the fucking money and all the taxes and all this stuff. Mm. And he built a new castle at Payne's Castle. But due to the castle building experience Llywelyn had learned over the years now, and the sense of unity between the Welsh, the king was unable to penetrate far into Wales, because Llywelyn himself became this great castle builder, and he built castles for defending. For the first time, we had like this great leader who was building Welsh castles
instead of subjugation castles.
So this war continued for about a year, with negotiations continuing into 1232, when Hubert was removed from office and then later imprisoned. So much of the power then passed to another guy called Peter, including control of several castles in South Wales. And it was much better for Llywelyn than the previous like owners of that. So so much of the power passed to Peter de Rivier, including control of several castles in South Wales. And then William Marshall, who'd attacked in West Wales previously, died in 1231. And his brother Richard succeeded him as the Earl of Pembroke. And in 1233, hostilities between Richard Marshall, who is this guy from Pembroke, and Peter de Rivier, who was supported by the king, Llywelyn made an alliance with Richard, the guy from Pembrokeshire. And in January, so that means Richard and Llywelyn are against Peter and the King of England. And then in 1234, Llywelyn raised and seized Shrewsbury, so he took over Shrewsbury. However, Richard, his ally, was killed in Ireland, so it all felt a bit mad having wars when one of the belligerents was now dead, so they just decided to make peace. They were like, right, let's stop this.
Knock on the edge.
And this period now is called the Peace of the Middle, and it was agreed on the 12th of June, 1234, where there was established truce for 2 years, and so they decided for 2 years they're going to have truce, and we're going to put Wales as Wales, England as England, and leave it as that. And the truce ended up being really successful, and they decided to renew it year upon year upon year. So for 6 years they did it, and it's called the Peace of the Middle because it's significant, because it marked a period of relative peace between and good relations between the Welsh and the English. So they were trading really well together.
Really heard of that.
Yeah, well, it's only 6 years in a period of about 600 years. Out of the lot. Yeah, of like 600 years, 6 years of it. So like 1%. And it's really noticeable because there's a big contrast to, like you said, what the history that precedes it and comes after it. It's the first time in centuries that there was 6 years of peace that between a separate England and Wales. So imagine only having it is crazy. So the Norman invasion had been going on for 150 years, and only 6 years of that was their peace. And obviously we know that peace didn't last forever, but for a brief period there was harmony before a further 200 years of war to follow. So it's like
It's quite likely you would not see that 6 years of peace. You know, that entire time you'd have to be born very specific time frame. This is all right. And the rest of it is just fucking war.
There were times where like Lord Rees had something similar, but he wasn't kind of seen as the leader of all of Wales. That's why Llywelyn's different, because he had peace for all of Wales, not just Deheubarth or Gwynedd. So in the later years, Llywelyn devoted much of his life and time ensuring his only legitimate son, David, would follow him as ruler of Gwynedd and amend Welsh law as follows. So he, you know, like we discussed this before, he'd stop it being all heirs get equal share.
The standard, wasn't it, where it splits between all your kids.
And we've discussed it before, and to the detriment of stability, Welsh rulers would split their land and inheritance between all legitimate and illegitimate sons, and in doing so would cause all this huge infighting and would break up power from one head of state to like four or five eldest sons, legitimate or not. And we get like... what happened at the start of this episode one, you have all these uncles and brothers and cousins killing each other. Llywelyn's amendment to Welsh law favouring legitimate children in a church-sanctioned marriage mirrored the earlier efforts of Lord Rees when he designated his son, Griffith ap Rees II, as the heir over the illegitimate ones. In both cases, favouring legitimate children born in a church-sanctioned marriage was to facilitate better relationships with their sons and then the wider Anglo-Norman polity and the Catholic Church by removing any stigma of illegitimacy. So it was actually like a really good thing to get on board with the English.
Yeah, it's like, when you think about it, oh, Cavran, that sounds really good, like splitting it equally between all your kids. It's like, oh, very fair. But like in terms of building your dynasty, if you like, or like your power and your control in the area, it's just so rife for being split up and like causing grief in it. So and like you said, that the parity then between the English way of doing things and the like the way the church looks at it, like tactically, it's kind of a no-brainer, I suppose.
And David's older brother, but illegitimate brother, Griffiths, was therefore excluded as the primary heir of Llywelyn, that would be given lands to rule, and this was a huge departure from Welsh custom, which held that the eldest son was his father's heir, regardless of his parents' marital status. So the oldest heir here didn't even get to be in charge of like the lion's share.
I mean,
because,
he got a bit of land. He's probably doing all right for like a medieval bloke, you know?
Yeah. So Llywelyn introduced the minority government of King Henry to acknowledge David as his heir. So he also then got Pope Honorius III to have David's succession confirmed. The original
not innocent anymore, honorous, I guess, close enough.
The Pope welcomed the fact that Llywelyn was abolishing that old custom where they were illegitimate people. That wasn't to what the Pope's liking. And then Llywelyn persuaded the Pope to declare his wife, Joan, David's mother, to be the legitimate daughter of King John. Beforehand, she was illegitimate. And then the English crown accepted David's homage to the lands he would inherit from his father. So it was all kind of set up to be like an actual dynasty and lineage. Llywelyn then held a council at Strata Florida Abbey where other Welsh princes swore fealty to David. So he was really trying to establish a lineage here. And he also set up good marriages for them. So land, when people, he arranged for his son David to marry Isabella de Brose, the eldest daughter of William de Brose. Because William de Brose had no male heir, Llywelyn strategized that the vast de Brose holdings in South Wales would now be passed to David. So he's just really thought ahead for this. And then Joan died in 1237. And
some more heartbreak for our boy.
That kind of killed him off. He suffered a stroke because of it, or they think maybe because of it. And he suffered a stroke when his wife died, and then he died not too long after.
Died of a broken heart.
It did. That's kind of what they say. He kind of died of a broken heart. His woman had gone. He saw nothing left for him. So from this time on then, David took an increasing part of the rule whilst he was having this stroke. And then David deprived his half-brother of the lands given to him by Llywelyn. So as soon as he dies,
he starts literally up again. Yeah.
So we'll come to that in another episode. But yeah, safe to say it kind of goes to pot afterwards. In the Bruta Tua Sogion in 1240, it said, "The Lord Llywelyn ap Iorwerth, Prince of Wales, son of Owain Gwynedd, a second Achilles, died, having taken the habit of religion at Aberconwy and was buried honourably." Llywelyn died at the Cistercian Abbey of Aberconwy, which he founded, and he was buried there. The abbey was later moved to Maen, becoming the Maenan Abbey near Llanrwst, and Llywelyn's stone coffin can now be seen at St. Gruff's Church, Llanrwst, among the poets who lamented his passing was Einion Wan. He wrote, "True Lord of the land, how strange that today he rules not over Gwynedd, Lord of naught but the piled up stones on his tomb. Oh, the 7-foot grave in which he lies." So you can read that poem when you go up to see his grave. So David succeeded Llywelyn as Prince of Gwynedd, but King Henry was not prepared to allow him to inherit his father's position in the remainder of Wales. So David was then forced to agree the treaty, greatly restricting his power, and also being obliged to hand his half-brother Griffith over to the king, who now had the option of using him against David. Griffith was later killed, attempting to escape the Tower of London. So We'll cover that in another episode because it can just go on forever. This kind
of... It was good while it lasted.
Yeah, I'll just wrap up quickly and say some final things I've written down. So Llywelyn dominated Wales for more than 40 years, and the first person to give Llywelyn the title the Great seems to have been someone from his near contemporary, who was an English chronicler called Matthew Paris. John Edward Lloyd, a historian, gave the following assessment of Llywelyn. Among the chieftains who battled against the Anglo-Norman power, his place will always be high, if not indeed the highest of all, for no man ever made better or more judicious use of native force of the Welsh people for adequate national ends. His patriotic statesmanship will always entitle him to wear the proud style of Llywelyn the Great. Although there's one different view, so David Moore gives a different view, where he says Llywelyn died in 1240. His His Principatus of Wales rested on shaky foundations. Although he had dominated Wales, exacted unprecedented submissions, and raised the status of the Prince of Gwynedd to new heights, his three major ambitions, a permanent hegemony, its recognition by the king, and its inheritance in its entirety to his heirs, remained unfilled. His supremacy, like that of Griffith ap Llywelyn, had merely personal in nature, and there had been no institutional framework to maintain it, either during his lifetime or after his death. So he's quite critical there, saying Llywelyn was amazing.
Bit harsh, I would say.
Well, I think he's saying, like, so there was one time there was one person who's been called king of all of Wales,
yeah.
And after him, he didn't set up a framework to have like another king. So, you know, like in England,
I know what you mean. It's like if you're thinking of objectives,
yeah,
you know,
you had like
not completed. But no, when he says it like that, it does sound like he's downplaying. Yeah. Like
his supremacy had been merely personal in nature. I was like, oh, fuck off, wicked.
Yeah.
Well, that's our Llywelyn episode done and dusted.
Brilliant. I can see why you said the other day he's fast become one of your faves.
Oh, yeah. I really, really, really like reading him, man.
And definitely could see this kind of Braveheart-esque film. Like we say to almost everyone we talk about.
Yeah. But this one, you could see it because he lives and dies. And like you have him coming up from literally nothing. He has to raise an army on his own. He's about 16 in his first battle. Mm. And then he fights for 40 years. And
got the epic story beats.
I might have read through it quite quickly, but there's a period where he took over 8 castles in like a space of one winter.
Sick.
Where he's just like, and imagine you can set the scene where it's like a wintry, you know, dead trees and all that malarkey, and he's just putting heads on spikes, and he gives you one option to surrender, and if you don't, he floods your things. And
that's so like Attila the Hunt style, isn't it? Like you get one chance, and then it's like fucking you're gone.
He caused dread, but he also caused like national pride, so many people were joining his cause and stuff, and he united one of the most fractious countries.
Stokes ever. Love with the Welsh and dread with the English. I love that. Yeah.
So yes, Diolch yn gwrando, guys. If you got this far, please drop us a 5-star review. It does help.
Please drop us five stars.
So, diolch yn gwrando, guys. We'll catch you all soon.
See you next time. Ta-ra, ta-ra, ta-ra.